Wednesday, November 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, South Korea's president says she may be willing to step down amid scandal.
But up to 16,000 people have been displaced, many into uncertain and precarious situations.
There is a shift in UN humanitarian aid to Syria. Also ahead, we go to Havana as residents mark the passing of Fidel Castro. Pakistan has a new army chief. Rihanna has new music. It's all on today's International Edition. South Korean President Park Geun-hye Tuesday expressed a willingness to step down from office once and if the National Assembly passes a measure requiring her to do so. Park addressed the nation in a hastily scheduled televised speech. She said she would leave her future, including leaving office, to the decision of the National Assembly.
저는 제 대통령직 임기 단축을 포함한
She said, I will leave my future course of action, including the shortening of my presidential term, to the decision of the National Assembly. VOA Northeast Asia correspondent Brian Padden in Seoul spoke a short time ago with International Edition host Sarah Williams about Park's statement.
She said if the conditions were right, if it can be arranged for her to step down in an orderly manner so that there's no gap in state affairs and that to minimize chaos and that there is a peaceful and stable transfer of power, if these arrangements can be made, she is willing to resign. She's been under a lot of pressure in the last few weeks because of this political scandal involving her longtime friend Choi Soon-sil, who has allegedly used her connections with President Park to force a number of conglomerates and large corporations to donate monies to sports and cultural foundations, and that she is being investigated also for funneling some of that money into her own businesses. And investigations into that scandal have brought charges against Choi Soon-sil and against her, some of President Park's closest advisors. The president herself has been named a criminal suspect. This is the first time ever that a sitting South Korean president has been named a criminal suspect in an investigation. So a lot of pressure has been building, and there have been 5 weeks now of massive public protests in the streets of Seoul and across the country. So she finally came out today after being somewhat secluded for the last couple of weeks and said that she would be willing to resign if the conditions are right.
Are the conditions right?
This is what concerns some of the opposition. The opposition has been pushing for impeachment proceedings, and they are prepared to put through a motion this week that could be voted on as early as Friday for impeaching President Park. The parliament, the National Assembly, needs a two-thirds majority of the 300-member National Assembly to approve an impeachment motion. The opposition parties already have 159 members and seem somewhat confident that they could get the rest from her party and other independent candidates and other independent members of parliament who would go along. President Park's gambit today to them seems cynical, and they are skeptical because they are saying this is a ploy to try to push back the impeachment effort, and that the conditions that she's asking for would be for the parliament to pick a new prime minister, to pick an interim cabinet that could take over for the president after the president resigns and before new elections are held. That process could take months for the various parties to get together and select all the appropriate candidates. So it's unclear if she is being sincere that she wants to maintain stability, or this is another cynical move on the president's part to kind of delay the process.
VOA's Brian Padden in Seoul. Be sure to check out voanews.com for much more on this story. It's time for us now to check out what's trending on the web. And for that, our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee, joins me here in Studio 22. Hi, G.
Hello, Jim.
President-elect Donald Trump had some thoughts on flag burning, which he tweeted, and that seems to be a very hotly debated topic on social media. What are the people saying?
You're absolutely right about it being trending on social media, but before we get on to the public's reactions on it, let's read the tweet by Mr. Trump. This is what he wrote. Nobody should be allowed to burn the American flag. If they do, there must be consequences, perhaps loss of citizenship or a year in jail. It's unclear what prompted this tweet, but more than 150,000 people liked that tweet, and it did draw negative reactions from legal professionals.
Okay, I'm sure First Amendment folks were not happy with that.
Right.
What are they saying about freedom of expression?
Yeah, so as you can imagine, this debate is surrounding whether the right to burn the American flag is protected under the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, and the verdict seems to be yes, it is. One of the top replies to that tweet is by a user named Kevin, who wrote, "If you arrest someone for burning the flag, you might as well burn the Constitution. That's just a fact." Another user named Olivia quoted Antonin Scalia, the late Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. He was quoted as saying, "If I were king, I would not allow people to go about burning the American flag. However, we have a First Amendment." On Instagram, the People for Bernie account shared an excerpt from a ruling that struck down laws prohibiting the flag burning as unconstitutional. It reads, "If there is a bedrock principle underlying the First Amendment, it is that the government may not prohibit the expression of an idea simply because society finds the idea itself offensive or disagreeable." That's it.
Okay. Were there any tweets from those who liked Trump's tweet?
Yeah, a user named Christy tweeted she agrees with Trump and that the SCOTUS was wrong in the 80s when they accepted flag burning as free speech. She added, "It isn't First Amendment, it's just hateful desecration. Hashtag MAGA, which stands for Make America Great Again." Jim?
All right. Thank you so much, G. You can follow our program's account on Twitter at VOA_IE. I'm out there as well at VOA Stevenson. And G goes under the name of, guess what? At G. Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia, South Korean president offers conditional resignation. Analysts say China's seizure of a Singaporean armored vehicles will have limited impact. Pakistan's new army chief takes over amid challenges. Guam land could go to traditional Chamorro healers. Drones mapping Indian cities where they're allowed. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at the VOAnews.com website. Also, take the news with you. If you have a smartphone, try out our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Cubans have been saying farewell to their late former autocratic leader Fidel Castro at Revolution Square in Havana. Later Wednesday, his ashes will be carried eastward across the country in a 3-day procession that follows in reverse the route taken by the young revolutionary and his rebel fighters as they advanced on Havana before taking power in January 1959. Reporter Ignacio Gonzalez is in Havana. He joins us with varied reactions to Fidel Castro's death and what may lay ahead for Cuba.
My generation, for example, grew up getting ready for a professionally better life. But years pass, and we graduate, and that better life never came. And I think that's one of the reasons why the young people like me, they don't really feel anything. We do not express any kind of feeling concerning the death of this ex-president Castro.
The older generation certainly can remember what happened when Castro came to power. How are they reacting?
That's another thing. Those are the people who are now, walking in line to see Fidel Castro's pictures and to sign all that book. Because that generation was the generation that saw how Fidel Castro gave them some kind of education, some kind of free healthcare. They give land and that stuff. Batista government wasn't perfect, and the whole population wasn't following Batista personality. And therefore, Fidel Castro is a person able to wake up passions among those that listen to him, because he's able to make you feel that something, that life is going to be better, because he has that power to convince the people. But the new generations, they have realized that all of that was a lie. This is the time in which the Cubans have the chance to do what they want to do, whatever they need to do to change the politics in our country.
Is there some expectation that you've heard of perhaps Cuba opening up more, perhaps better relations with the United States now that President Obama has visited the island, perhaps new businesses and money flowing into the country?
When Fidel Castro was in the power, who could imagine that this kind of relationship would be able to exist? A lot of people, they think that these changes are not going to be made. But for I'm here in Havana, for example, and I'm starting to see a lot of different construction. There are been building new hotels, new enterprises. I think the big changes concerning political changes and economic changes are going to exist after this death of former President Fidel Castro.
Incoming President Donald Trump has made some very harsh comments about Cuba. What is the sentiment that you are hearing among people? Will Donald Trump maybe be a help to Cuba, or do they feel as if there's going to be some continued friction?
Donald Trump is more like a businessman, like a political man. People are starting to focus on a new idea. The idea that Donald Trump is a businessman, and that if he sees the opportunity to invest in Cuba, and concerning and if you see that Raúl Castro and Cuba's economy is down, we need that injection. So the Cuban people are thinking that Donald Trump could help a lot. Cuba.
Ignacio Gonzalez in Havana, thank you so much for your insight and time.
Thank you very much.
United Nations aid agencies say they are shifting many humanitarian operations to Syrian government-controlled western Aleppo. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The United Nations says thousands of people have been fleeing eastern Aleppo in the wake of intensified ground fighting and indiscriminate aerial bombardment by Syrian government forces. The government reportedly has retaken more than one-third of the territory previously held by the rebels. Jens Laerke, spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, says scores of civilians reportedly have been killed and injured, and civilian infrastructure has been deliberately destroyed.
The intensity of attacks in eastern Aleppo neighborhoods over the past few days has forced thousands of civilians to flee to other parts of the city. Initial reports indicate that up to 16,000 people have been displaced, many into uncertain and precarious situations. It's likely that thousands more will have no choice but to flee should fighting continue to spread and intensify over the coming days.
The World Food Program distributed its last stock of food rations to the people of eastern Aleppo on November 13th. WFP spokeswoman Bettina Lucia says once the agency gets the go-ahead, it wants to send in food to eastern Aleppo from its warehouses in the western part of the city.
With hundreds of families fleeing eastern Aleppo, WFP is mobilizing food stocks to meet the immediate needs of the people of these newly displaced families. We have 30,000 family food rations in West Aleppo, 20,000 ready-to-eat food rations in Kamishli.
Lucia says the WFP is providing bread, ready-to-eat rations, and cooked food to help those thousands of people who have fled from the east to the west. The UN Refugee Agency says it has emergency stocks on hand for 45,000 people in western Aleppo and is ready to move more supplies, such as blankets, tents, and sheets, to help the displaced people in western Aleppo keep warm during the winter months. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Pakistan's army has a new commander, considered to be one of the most powerful men in the country. VOA's Aisha Tanzim reports from Islamabad.
Military drummers band away in their multicolored uniforms and heavily starched turbans. The crowd included top military brass and their families. The change of command ceremony was shown live on TV news channels in Pakistan. A change in command could have possible implications on the future of democracy in Pakistan as well as its foreign policy. Outgoing Army Chief General Raheel Sharif called his successor, General Qamar Javed Bajwa, a strong decision-maker and reminded him of the challenges that await him. The region faces a complicated security situation and Pakistan has not overcome all of its challenges yet, General Sharif said. He was referring to the internal security situation in the country as well as rising tensions with its neighbors. A decade of extremist violence has killed tens of thousands of Pakistanis. A military clearing operation launched 2 years ago helped, but work remains. Tensions with both Pakistan's neighbor on the east, India, and neighbor on the west, Afghanistan, are high. India and Pakistan have for weeks traded fire across the line of control, the de facto border in the disputed Kashmir region in the north of the country, while Afghanistan claims Pakistan helps its enemies, the Afghan Taliban. Pakistan strongly denies the charges. The most important challenge for the new military chief, though, might be to ease the tension between Pakistan's top civilian and military leadership. The two sides have been at odds for months. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. A highly successful singer has a new single that's racing up the charts. International Edition's Sarah Williams and Border Crossings host Larry London talk about the latest release.
Rihanna, she has accomplished quite a lot at the tender age of 28. It's amazing if you think about this. She's had 14 number one songs. Only the Beatles and Elvis have had more number one songs than Rihanna. And she's also got her eighth album out, which was a number one album for her. The album's called Anti. It got quite a few awards recently at the American Music Awards. She was the favorite female R&B singer, favorite album there. However, at the Soul Train Awards, she was nominated for five, went home empty-handed. She was 0 for 5 at that awards show. Most of the awards that Rihanna was up for went to Beyonce in the same category. But she just wrapped up her recent Anti-tour, which took her all around the world. She's got a brand new song, which is her fourth release from the Anti album. And that's the song that I picked to play today because I love this song. Rihanna has the unique ability to sing a love song just as well as she sings her upbeat dance music and funk music. She can change colors like a chameleon. She can change her sounds. I really like Rihanna. She's the real deal. And so we're going to listen to her new song, which is called Love on the Brain.
And you got me let go. What you want from me?
What you want from me?
And try to buy your pretty heart with a price too high.
Now, where is Rihanna from originally?
She is from Barbados. And her real name is Robin Rihanna Fenty. She goes by her middle name. But, you know, she's been doing music for a long, long time. She was discovered by Jay-Z, who signed her to her very first contract many moons ago when she released her first number one song, Ponda Replay. And since that time, as I mentioned a little while ago, she's had 14 number one songs. She made it to Forbes' highest paid women in music under 30 list at number 5. This year has been very lucrative for Rihanna, with $75 million she's earned in the past 12 years. That wasn't number one. Number one went to Taylor Swift, who brought in $170 million. But Rihanna's not that far behind at $75 million. And she sold over 200 million records. So the sales continue. Rihanna's success continues. And this particular week is a special week in her career, because if you go back to 2012, this week, she was number one with a song called Diamonds off her very first number one album, Unapologetic. And so here she is now, two number ones later, and she's doing very well, which is why I wanted to focus on Rihanna and her new song, which hasn't hit number one yet. But if I were a betting man,
probably,
which I'm not.
Probably likely to do so.
Likely to do so, because it's time for a ballad, and this is a beautiful ballad.
All right, thanks very much. That's VOA's Larry London, the host of Border Crossings.
Must be love on the brain. That's got me feeling this way. It beats me black and blue, but it fits me so good and I can't get it.
And while Rihanna aims for number one, we think you're number one. Thanks for listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Be sure to check us out on Facebook at VOA Now. Follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter. Engineer Jimmy Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States, together with Taiwan, known in the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum, or APEC, as Chinese Taipei, announced their intent to create an APEC subfund on women and the economy, which will enable APEC economies to apply for funding to support new or existing initiatives focused on women's empowerment. This year marks the 5th anniversary of the San Francisco Declaration, in which APEC ministers and senior officials agreed to take concrete actions to integrate women more fully into APEC economies. Over the last 5 years, the United States has championed a number of initiatives through APEC that build on the commitment to advance women's roles in APEC economies through compiling and analyzing data, strengthening the regional ecosystems for entrepreneurs, promoting women's health, and advancing women and girls in traditionally male-dominated sectors, including science, technology, engineering, and math, known as STEM, and transportation. This year, the United States launched a new initiative to break down barriers to women's participation in STEM-related fields. The initiative consisted of an APEC-wide research study to examine efforts across the region to increase women's participation in these fields, and two workshops in which representatives from the private sector, civil society, and governments shared best practices and lessons learned from ongoing programs. The United States also continues to support the We APEC initiative in order to identify and connect women's entrepreneurship networks in each economy with public and private sector support services and global supply chains to ultimately expand economic opportunities and regional trade. Sustainable economic growth cannot be achieved if women are unable to fully participate in the economy due to health concerns. To address this issue, the United States, together with the Philippines, launched the Healthy Women, Healthy Economies Initiative, a public-private partnership that is working to advance women's health and well-being to increase their economic participation. In addition, 5 APEC economies, including the United States, have launched pilot activities aimed at increasing women's engagement across the transportation sector. It is clearly in the interest of the economies in the region to integrate women into the economy. It has been proven time and again, said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, that where women are participating fully, the society tends to be more stable, it tends to be participatory, and particularly, it tends to be more productive.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.